Hello and welcome to episode 11 of WB40, a podcast about technology with me, Matt Ballantyne, and Chris Weston. Nice to be with you again, and nice to be with you, Mr. Weston. How's it going?
I'm very well, thank you, Mr. Ballantyne. Very well indeed. It's been another interesting week. Lots going on. Loads of interesting people to meet and discussions about the good and the bad of technology. How about yourself?
A mixed emotional, mostly emotional week. Last week, somebody who I didn't know but was very important in my life, Graham Taylor, the football manager, passed away, and that, as a Watford fan, is a significant thing. And I was surprisingly shaken up by all of that, actually. Very bizarre. And then tonight got home and found our next-door neighbours had been burgled. So now I'm looking at the market for IP CCTV cameras. I'm not so bothered about it, but to be able to put other people in the household's minds at rest.
Yeah, IP cameras. That's there is a real big market in that now. I mean, the IoT world generally is hugely accelerating, and something that I was talking about when I was doing some speaking last year on smart buildings and things. I was talking about this kind of about to explode IoT market, and now that it's just gone crazy this year, and the number of home security devices that allow you to put a camera in your house and you can look at your camera, your phone when you're on holiday and see if anybody's in it, which always it seems like a great idea, but what are you going to do? What if you're on holiday and you look at your phone and see somebody traipsing about your house? Surely you want somebody else to be looking at it who's nearby, not sitting on a beach in Jamaica or Tenerife, or wherever you happen to be.
Bridlington. Seriously, we're looking at booking holidays at the moment. Bridlington's about as far as we're going to get. I think, yeah, it's interesting because some friends of ours, they had a proper, you know, big grown-up alarm system put in last year, and they gave us the keys for it when they went away. And basically, they're cleaner. Because not only because they can afford alarm systems, they can afford cleaners as well. Their cleaner managed to not set it properly, and then we got called out. And the whole thing basically is, what it's made me realise is, actually I think an IP camera system, as long as it's reasonably reliable, and reliability is an interesting question about all of this, but it's probably as good a way to go. Because basically what you do, you see something going on, and then you phone the police. Because basically that's all that ADT or whoever else are going to do. But you can do it without having to, first of all, call around all the people you've put on the list who will do it before they call the police. And it's just, I don't know, we'll see where it gets to. But to be honest, there's a bit of me going, yeah, get one of these camera things. And then I think back to that first or early episode that we did. And yes, but if I put an IPTV thing on my network, am I more likely to get taken out by Russian hackers than I am by burglars at the back door? And so to be honest, it's weighing off one security risk with another, quite frankly.
Well, that's right. If you think the Russians maybe one day use this compromat on you as they've watched you pad around the house in your underpants, they'll be able to hold some sway over you when you eventually hold high office in this country.
I wish I had something to be compromised about. So this week, Christopher, we have an interview that you did with a lady called Kylie Fowler, who is an expert in software licensing, and we'll get into the interview in a little bit, but what you were talking about more broadly was some of the business changes that are associated with the move into cloud and particularly into software as a service.
Yeah, we did some, we had some conversations around this, didn't we, in a previous episode of the podcast where we talked about the different the changing role of the CIO and the changing relationship between organizations and the software they use, and which is all great from a high level point of view and an interesting conversation. But when you get into the nuts and bolts of it, and Kylie is a really, really fantastic person to talk to on this subject because she's been involved in software asset management for a long time and has seen the kind of rise of software as a service licensing models alongside the traditional software on-premise licenses. So being able to talk to somebody who has spent so much time understanding how that all works is really interesting, and get into the detail of it. I think once people have heard Kylie talk, they'll be thinking twice about going into any kind of strategic decisions around software or vendor negotiation without considering some of the things she's talking about.
I think it's interesting as well, the thinking about how the business of software is changing. And as we'll hear, Kylie starts to touch on quite a number of areas in that. But it's interesting that the shift from on-premise models of software to cloud-based models of software is something that actually means quite a dramatic rethinking of a bunch of things for software vendors or service vendors as they become. And I think we're only, particularly in, you know, very specifically business and enterprise software, I think we're only just starting to scratch the surface of the impact of all of that. But look, something I've noticed, and I might have spoken about this before on the podcast, but if you look in any particular industry vertical, you will find software that is commoditized enough that it can be a piece of software that's offered to many companies competing in the same market, but is unique to that market. So case management systems in the world of law, or housing management systems in the world of housing associations. There's quite a lot of them in things like local government. There's, you know, a stack of services that are designed for local government. Those ones, I think, are really well behind the curve in terms of the transition to cloud, because they've basically got maybe two or three companies who are competing in that particular software market. They generally tend to be, or in many cases, they tend to be very geographically specific. And basically, they don't have any inclination to move away from the, you know, the client server implementation that they basically knocked out 25 years ago and have put a few skins on top of ever since. For the big software vendors, though, it's as big a challenge. And I know that, you know, if you look at, particularly with Microsoft, I think over the last 10 years, it's been a really hard transition for them as they start to work out what realigning around software as a service means. And it has such an impact from the licensing models, as we'll hear, through to the way in which they incentivize sales teams, the way in which they incentivize their resellers, to whether they need resellers anymore, to how they develop software, how they release software. Root and branch, it changes just about everything about the way in which software is consumed, delivered, created, marketed, sold, accounted for, the lot. Anyway, let's hear how you got on with Kylie when you met last week.
Okay, so I'm with Kylie Fowler, and we're going to talk about software asset management. And Kylie's been in the business of software asset management for over 10 years, we're going to say, aren't we, Kylie?
Yeah.
And
I started young.
And we're going to talk about how software asset management is changing in organisations, particularly around cloud models, and how organisations are starting to understand how they're going to lead negotiations and work through new procurement models in with this technology. So, Kylie, what do you see the change coming in terms of how vendors are going to approach pricing strategies with software as a service models as opposed to their on-prem models?
I think a critical thing to recognise around on-prem models is that there was a huge asymmetry of information about the value of that software. So the customer had a much better idea of the value of the software than the vendor did, even though it might not seem like that sometimes. As vendors move their software into the cloud, they're going to be able to see exactly how that software is being used on a day-to-day basis, exactly who is using it, where they're using it, what they're using it for. So that's actually going to probably, let's face it, in many ways, shift the asymmetry away from the customer into the vendor's favour. So I think at the moment, a lot of customers actually don't even know themselves what value they're receiving from that piece of software, which is why we often see a lot of overpurchasing and a lot of sweating of assets. So the vendor is going to develop a much clearer idea of the value of that software for the customer, as I said, focusing on, going to use this word a lot, value. And we're going to see a lot more creative license metrics come along that are much more based upon how the vendor is actually, how the customer is actually using the software. So there'll be a lot more bespoke license metrics that seek to align the value the customer is receiving with the pricing that the vendor is receiving as well.
And do you think that vendors are going to struggle to to work that through. With some of their models at the moment, they're making a lot of money from some customers, not so much money from another. Some of this shakeout is going to highlight a lot of that, and maybe some customers are going to get a better deal than they used to, but some are going to be paying a lot more. Do you think that that's going to happen?
I think that's absolutely right. At the moment, software negotiations are really an attempt, or the best software negotiations, they're an attempt by the vendor to judge the best value of that software for that particular customer. Distribution costs for on-premise software are incredibly low. So in many ways, customers had the ability to really drive down the price of software, because from a vendor's perspective, any sale was better than no sale, as long as it didn't devalue the software as a whole within the entire market. The ability for customers to take advantage of year-end deals and things like that is dramatically going to increase, because distribution costs are entirely irrelevant in a cloud service. The main costs relating to a cloud service are actually the infrastructure costs, and genuinely economies of scale will become much more important. The more you actually put into the cloud, the higher the vendor's economies of scale, and therefore the better pricing you will be able to achieve.
So you've talked about how companies can leverage their scale when doing software deals, and that's always been a traditional way of getting a better deal from your software company. The bigger you are, the better the deal you should expect. Are there any other ways that companies can get leverage in these deals with new software as a service models?
Yes, for companies, adoption and deployment is absolutely critical. If you take Microsoft, for instance, their claim to be the biggest provider of cloud software in the world, I think that's one of their claims, I'm not exactly sure what it is, but it is a claim like that, is based solely upon the number of people who are using Office 365 in the cloud. So it's not enough anymore for them to sell you a load of Office 365 licenses. You have to actually start using them. You have to actually have people putting data up into the cloud and accessing that cloud platform in order for Microsoft to be able to make that claim. So when you are negotiating with a software vendor, a really key area of leverage will be your plans to migrate from on-prem into the cloud and to actually get people accessing that cloud platform. In order to demonstrate to a vendor that you are serious about that, it's often actually quite helpful to share your migration program or business case, for instance, and the vendor can help you understand what that migration might look like and the things you need to consider in your business case. It actually can be quite a powerful way of communicating to the vendor that you're deadly serious about where you're going. And the other thing is that many vendors, particularly the larger vendors, will bend over backwards to provide you with additional benefits that will help you with that migration program. Whether that's technical support, whether that's access to specialist consultancies, funding to take advantage of some of those consulting opportunities, think about how your vendor can support you with that deployment program, and then help use that within your negotiation to seek additional value that goes beyond the sheer price point. I think companies that are purely focused on price point at this particular moment in time run the risk of leaving a lot of value on the table. That's going to change in the next 3 to 5 years. Your most powerful time, of course, is always to drive down cost, is always in your first contract. So you do need to bear that in mind, that whatever benchmark you set now will be the benchmark that you're stuck with for the duration of that relationship. But actually, you will find that the deployment side of it is so critical for that vendor that there will be additional value that you can request and obtain as well.
So, Kylie, thinking about then the types of businesses which really benefit from cloud models, my experience is that if you're a small company, a startup, the lack of requirement to invest in capital equipment, in physical kit, that's great. You know, you can get up to speed and running, go up and running very quickly. Large companies can leverage their scale. mid-sized companies, I think, get a little bit squeezed sometimes. And so what do you think about that? Do you think mid-sized companies still have advantage from using software as a service model?
So I think that the mid-sized companies, or the mid-sized companies of the future, will have come up growing from that small size, the small model, using cloud. And are they going to go back on-prem? I think that's actually pretty unlikely, because it would be very challenging for them to find the resources to allow them to build out an on-premise solution. I think those resources are going to become scarcer and scarcer, and will probably be snapped up by the really large companies that have no choice but to maintain a significant on-premise infrastructure. But I think the benefit of being able to scale up and scale down quickly within cloud, even though, of course, vendors try and minimise your ability to do so. For instance, you know, you might have to commit for a year at a time. You won't be able to scale down for another year. But actually, that is still hugely valuable to mid-sized companies. These are companies that are constantly being blown around by the winds of economic change, having to scale up quickly to meet new opportunities and scale down when, you know, business is not doing as well as they had hoped. And the cloud really gives them an unparalleled ability to do that, that they would completely lose if they move on-prem. Of course, moving on-prem does allow you to sweat your assets. So any mid-sized companies that decided that they wanted to either move to on-prem or to retain any existing on-premise infrastructure will find that quite valuable. But I think as a strategy for the majority of medium-sized companies, cloud has still got a lot of things going for it.
So are there any reasons for companies to retain or move to on-prem solutions, do you think?
I think the crux of it for if we start off with the mid-sized companies will be very much around the competitive advantage that IT brings to their business. If you're a business that genuinely lives or dies by your IT, you will want control over that IT, and you won't want to run the risks associated with having your intellectual property and your the lifeblood of your business in the cloud in somebody else's hands. But I don't think there's actually that many businesses that are in that position. I obviously, we all know, we're all IT people, we know that companies will die if their IT goes under, but that's not the same as the company knowing that they live or die by their IT, that their competitive advantage is entirely wound up in their IT and the intellectual property enshrined within that IT. That's a different thing entirely, and I don't think that's the case for many companies at the moment, genuinely speaking. Larger companies, I don't know that they would quite learn to love their on-prem infrastructure. That might be a bit of a strong word, but I think large companies are really going to, particularly banks, highly regulated organisations, are going to keep a lot of stuff on-prem. And I've seen a lot of the larger companies I work with starting to think seriously about what true hybrid cloud on-prem environments entail and how to build that out properly. I read somewhere many years ago an observation that very few forms of media have actually ever died. I think probably the scroll and the slate are the only ones that have ever died away, but we still use books, we still use radio, we still go out to the cinema, we still watch TV, we've added in now on-demand Netflix, etc. And I think if you think about large, highly regulated organisations, banks are still living or dying by their mainframes. They're going to be living or dying by their server-client on-prem infrastructure for a long time yet as well. So the on-prem side of things is not going to go away. But I think what will happen is that the split between cloud and on-prem is going to become a real divide within the software vendor community.
So do you think that means then that we will see a slew of companies targeting that legacy environment and those legacy applications, but the more mainstream will be a cloud-based, software-as-a-service-based type of model?
Absolutely. I think we're seeing that already. We're seeing that in a couple of different areas at the moment. One is the rise of third-party maintenance suppliers. And these are people who will support your legacy Oracle or IBM platforms to allow you to actually cancel that expensive maintenance, which is usually 20 to 25% of the license cost indexed to inflation over however many years you've owned that license. You can now drop that support, and or you now have the option to drop that support and move to third-party maintenance. And that actually brings huge benefits to companies that otherwise would suffer forced upgrades. For instance, IBM will force you to upgrade your entire middleware platform because they will no longer support the older products. So you can't ring, if something goes wrong, you can't ring them up anymore. Whereas these third-party maintenance people are snapping up the talent that was originally developed those legacy platforms within IBM, have snapped up that talent and are now employing them to support those legacy platforms, so they can actually support the entire range of IBM's legacy software when IBM refuses to do that. Now, the other interesting company that I've been reading a lot about recently is Micro Focus. They recently snapped up HP's software portfolio, and prior to that, they have purchased a significant portfolio of legacy software. They purchased Attachmate about 4 years ago, and software asset managers made hay for a short while with a wave of Attachmate audits, which were very nasty for a lot of companies, and we're all wondering when the wave of HP audits is going to start cascading through the industry. But Micro Focus's dedicated aim, the purpose of that business, is actually to continue to extract the value from that software that people are using. Now, why would you continue using legacy software? Well, the main thing is because these are often on you. A, you own the software, so it's yours, it's perpetual, whereas cloud is not. But the second thing is that these platforms are extremely stable. The risk of upping and lifting a highly integrated, extremely business sensitive platform, system, you know, middleware, everything into the cloud is extremely high, not to mention just the costs of managing that program, of finding the people who are actually capable of doing the technical work required. Why not just leave them sit there, reduce your maintenance, your support and maintenance costs dramatically by taking advantage of a third-party maintenance supplier? I suspect Micro Focus probably provides that service for the software in its portfolio as well. And you know what? Bob's your uncle. You've got the same... You're just doing what you did with your mainframes, but you're doing it with your client server environments.
So since we are completely convinced that SaaS is the model for the future and everything's going to go that way, it's important to recognise some of the risks around SaaS. And a lot of it, the traditional risk that people see is information security, although I think a lot of that has been abated. A lot of people realise that data is safer in Google's data centre than it is in theirs. But there are risks to moving your data into these providers. What do you think companies should be looking at?
Well, I think first and foremost has got to be the new GDPR legislation that's coming through. I think it's going to be very challenging for companies to start categorising and understanding data and where it is and managing that. But it's not actually purely a SaaS issue or a cloud issue. That's across the board, whether your data's on-prem or wherever it's being stored. The bigger issue actually is when you fall out of love with your SaaS provider. How are you going to get the data out? When you go into a SaaS contract, you need to have a plan to get out. And of course, most companies don't, but in an ideal world, you would be negotiating that contract with a view to understanding how you're going to get out. What are you going to need from the vendor in order to allow you to get your data out? How long is it going to take? What sort of things do you need to negotiate into that contract to ensure that all of those boxes are ticked? That's a really important thing that people should think about up front. The other big issue, of course, is a lot of businesses are finding that shadow IT is starting to grow again, and that's because the business has a business need, whips out the credit card, jumps online, finds a particular piece of SaaS software that does the trick for them and starts using it. And if that SaaS software actually hits the spot and really helps that business, then it's going to grow and grow and grow and grow. And who knows what data is in that SaaS provider. Nobody's vetted the contract to understand the exit strategy prior to actually entering that contract. But suddenly this piece of software is business critical. And not only do you have the issue of, okay, well, we're out of love with this vendor, we want to move, but what happens if your small SaaS provider goes under and you've suddenly realised that the corporate administrators are giving you 10 days to get your data out, and this is absolutely business critical data? That's a massive issue that business people don't really understand when they do whip out that credit card. Interestingly, there is an existing industry, the escrow industry, which has traditionally been storing source code for software, for commercial software, to ensure that if a company goes under, it's still available. And that's the escrow industry. But I think with SaaS, actually, that industry is probably going to grow again, you know, a long-term stock pick there, because there's just so many SaaS providers out there. And it is so important that you maintain access to that data if something goes wrong. So what are the risks? The biggest one, another very big one, of course, is what happens when your contract expires and you need to negotiate it. And I think, again, a bit of planning is really important to make sure that when you're renegotiating a cloud contract, the vendor understand you help the vendor to understand that you have alternatives. So never enter a cloud negotiation without understanding what your best alternative to a negotiated solution is. Can you just drop that cloud vendor? Get the data out, drop it. Do you have another cloud vendor lined up that potentially you could go to? Do you have options on-prem? You need to understand what all those options are in order to ensure that you are maximising your leverage for the future negotiations.
So what about the governance and management of software then, Kylie? How does that change in this environment?
So at the moment, governance of software is very focused on ensuring that the business operations work smoothly and properly. And I don't think that's going to change. You know, service operations is still going to be the most important thing because, of course, the business needs to use that software. However, from a software asset management perspective, we've been very focused on compliance for many, many years now. Audits have been the big bugbear that all companies have faced. I actually run a software asset management networking group, and we had a panel discussion late last year about the future of audits, and it was pretty unanimous that audits aren't going to go away. And I think we will continue to see audits of legacy software, potentially driven by companies like Micro Focus, who have a portfolio of legacy software, and they want to continue maximising the value of that legacy portfolio, and audits will always be an effective way to achieve that. Gartner just recently published a paper that has found that actually in the SaaS, that the requirement to actually manage SaaS is probably now a more important driver than compliance. We've reached a tipping point, as they've said in the title of their paper. And I would agree, actually. So we need to start gearing up our software asset management teams to cope with both the ongoing threat of audits over their legacy software, but also to ensure that we're managing the SaaS portfolio and the cloud portfolio effectively. And I'm not seeing many companies recognising that that's actually a really major change that they need to help their SAM teams through. SAM teams are often just left on their own to do the best they can. They're the team that constantly brings problems to the CIO rather than solutions. But actually the problems, the nature of the problems that they will be bringing are changing quite significantly. I mean, audits have long been the epitome of low probability but high impact risks. And SaaS actually has the opposite. It has a high probability but low impact risk. because every time you've got a user on your platform that you're paying for who's not actually using that platform, you're wasting money. It's death by a thousand cuts. So you need to gear your SAM teams up to cope with both the compliance black swan risk, it's not strictly speaking a black swan, but details, as well as to combat that day-to-day waste of tiny little sums of money that will add up to a big river of money if you're not careful.
Well, thanks, Kylie. That really is massively informative, and I think it highlights to me how silly it would be to go into a negotiation or buy a new piece of software without really getting your software asset management into place. Really, lots of things to think about there.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me on the show. I've enjoyed all your podcasts so far, and I'm very proud to be able to contribute my might, so to speak. So thanks very much.
You're welcome.
And I'll speak to you soon, hopefully.
You're welcome.
Fantastic. Chris, good work. We'll send you out into the field again. Good to hear some... Actually, for me, that's been really quite thought-provoking. I've been thinking quite a lot about some of the challenges around volume models recently with some of the work I've been doing, and that there's a fundamental change with software as a service from traditional on-premise models, and the fundamental change is that if you've got a piece of software that you just distribute the software, the incremental cost of delivering that software is basically nothing. You can sell a million licenses, and the physical costs associated with a million licenses is little different to selling one license. It doesn't scale quite like that. But with software as a service, though, because the service provider is actually providing the service, if you've got a million people using it, it's much, much more expensive than if you've got one person using it. And whilst it might not be a straight line, because there's economies of scale in terms of the hosting provision and all the rest of it, that's got to reflect through at some point with the way in which software as a service licensing goes. Now, it could be that just the prices continue to come down. The cost of utilitized hardware and hosting becomes so low that actually that just continues on that downward path. But the thing that I think Kylie picked up on, there seems to be this window of opportunity, particularly for the traditional vendors, where because they want to be able to evidence that they've got real people using their real services, and those numbers still are fairly low for most of the traditional vendors, I think there's an interesting opportunity for being able to get a volume discount now, because it will help the Microsofts and the Oracles and the others, the traditional software vendors of this world, to be able to show, look how many people we've got going on cloud now. I think I saw something just before Christmas that said for Office 365, there are 85 million active online cloud-based subscribers for that. So people using cloud services for email and whatever. And actually, in the great scheme of the Office franchise, that's probably less than 1%. It's not a big number. So that I found really interesting about that. Your reflections, having a few days since the interview to mull over it?
Well, I think that's a fair point that Kylie made very well, that there are still opportunities to push for those push that adoption benefit for the vendor to get discounts based on that. And I think you're right. There's a herd mentality that everybody wants to create, isn't there? Everybody's using this, so why don't you? And even as you say, those numbers are relatively small, and they don't necessarily tell you who's using it. I think if you buy an Office 365 license now, and you get a CD or you download the software, you get the cloud version thrown in. So do you really know who's using it and who's using a bit of desktop software? I think one of the things she mentioned, and again, another really interesting point, is that the vendors will be able to use cloud, and they'll be forced to use cloud and software as a service to come up with a bit more intelligent licensing models. So it's not just the number of seats that you're buying, but you'll be paying per transaction, or you'll be paying per active user for a period of time. And which leads on to another of our points about the fact that it's actually the cost of managing software as a service is different to managing on-prem software. And if you are, often when you buy an on-prem license, that's it, you bought the license, you can't get any benefit from from taking your user account down, apart from a bit of support costs. Whereas with software as a service, you really should get benefit at the end of the year or whenever you get a chance to review this, of getting some scalability up and down. So managing that, making sure that you have got the right amount of users, that you're paying for the right right number of processor cycles or storage space, and that will be a different discipline for enterprises as well.
There's some interesting conversation I've been having recently about identity and identity management in organizations, and how it's a couple of steps with this, but HR systems and movers, leavers, joiners processes are a key trigger for being able to effectively manage identity in an organization. And that happens in different places to different levels of success. And you've got the stuff that isn't covered by HR, and that all gets a bit messy. But if you assume that your HR system, which is supporting your joiners, leavers, movers, processes, is currently on-premise, and then you move to cloud. If you move to something like Workday, and I've seen this with a few organizations, once you move to a cloud-based service for your HR system, an awful lot, because all of the feeding and tendering of the back end is all gone, a lot of the administration stuff then actually makes much more sense to locate into the HR department, because the HR department is then controlling their own destiny, and they don't need to worry about any of the technical stuff because that's being managed by the cloud provider. All good so far, except then you'll get the weird thing happening where HR managing a system will be responsible for core data being delivered in the system that they're responsible for, that triggers everything in IT. And that those processes then would be sitting in a system that is run completely in the auspices outside of the control of the IT department. That's all probably a good thing, but that's going to be massive change across, you know, the most, you know, most normal medium to large size organisations. That the triggering of setting up user accounts will be not only done by HR through a process, but sitting in a system that is managed by HR and a third party outsource provider exclusively. And yet will trigger everything about then the cost of consuming software, because an awful lot of the cost of software will be triggered by how many accounts there are active at any given time, which will be the responsibility of the HR department. Those sorts of implications, you know, it's a bit theoretical, but those sorts of implications, we're going to start to see some really interesting stuff coming out in the next few years as to how and who is managing technology in organisations.
I think that's right. And I think some people would say, including me, that that's it's a natural evolution. You should be responsible for your own data as a owner of a business function. So why would the IT department own HR data? It really shouldn't, and it really shouldn't have to get involved at all. If we can get to the point where they don't have to get involved and they're just dealing with the nuts and bolts of making sure the software is available, all to the good, I think. But I do understand it is a shift. It's a cultural shift in many organisations. But that's the world of software as a service. I was at this conversation has reminded me about a book that I was given about 5 years ago by a chap called Ian Gotts, who he had a business that sold process software. He still does it, I think, quite successfully. And he and a colleague wrote a book about how to purchase a cloud solution. And this was in 2011, so a little while ago, not. When cloud was and software as a service was in its infancy, really, and the number of questions, they were fascinating. Basically, the book was a list of questions and the reason why you should ask them. And most of the questions were not technology questions per se. Most of the questions were around the adoption, what effects it's going to have on the business, why are you doing it, what benefits you're expecting to get, what things will you lose. And since then, when I've done this sort of thing, then you start to think about more technological things, but also more practical things like, okay, so what's connected to what latency did you expect? And I bought a bit of cloud software just a couple of years ago, where you could choose to get this software on premise or for the vendor to provide it via the cloud. And I wanted to do a software as a service. Everybody was happy with that. But on using the service, it was pretty unusable in terms of its speed, in terms of the way the screens refresh and things, just things like that you have to go through in testing. So we thought, we'll put it on premise. We got it on premise. We put it on the server. We looked at their specifications for what you needed to run this stuff. and it ran fine. So the question is, well, are you using those recommendations to run your cloud service? Oh, no, of course they're not. So even the vendors aren't using their own, they're not following their own rules sometimes because the costs are there, you sweat your assets, you do all those things. And when vendors turn into people running software on-prem, they don't always have the right skills or the right mindset to do it as well as an organization that hosts that software would.
So interesting stuff. Thanks again to Kylie for joining Chris for the interview. We'll put details for her on the website at wp40podcast.com.
Well, that's another fascinating half hour or so. Brilliant stuff from Kylie. As Matt says, we'll put her details on the website so that if you want to get in touch with her to beg her wisdom, you can do. I don't know what we're going to do next week. We've got a few plans in mind for next week's podcast. We might have to concentrate on Matt's technical ability in setting up IP cameras. What do you think, Matt?
I think that could be what takes up my week. So yeah, we'll see where it goes. Now, we've got a few interviews that we're working on trying to get at the moment. So it's the luck of the draw about which ones of those come through, and therefore a dynamic and agile programming schedule is the way that WB40 podcast rocks. Thanks for joining us. We're back next week. Make sure you subscribe on iTunes or through our website at wb40podcast.com. Follow us on Twitter. Tell us about what you think of it. It's always good to get some feedback. Speak soon.